Champaign County has one of Illinois' largest populations of immigrants outside the Chicago area, and it's a population apart from the university student group. A new report has the details. Plus, new research shows 90% of nurses experienced some sort of violence on the job over the past year.
It starts to become a place of tears on the way to work because you don't know what's going to happen that day. It affects all of us, and we start to become hardened. And that's not the type of nurse any of us want to be.
That's ER nurse Karina Johannesson speaking to the Chicago Tribune last summer. Today, why this is happening and what's being done about it. Plus, how are Chicago Bears players reacting to the NFL ruling yesterday about protesting the national anthem?
From the beginning, no one's intent, and I think no one's purpose was to disrespect the flag, was to protest police brutality against people of color.
That's linebacker Sam Acho. All of that coming up this hour on the 21st. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, the troubling statistics about violence nurses face on the job and what people in Illinois are trying to do to change that. We'll also be talking about the NFL's decision that NFL players can't protest the national anthem by taking a knee and how Chicago Bears players are reacting to that. But first, when immigrants come to Illinois, where do they go? Chicago for sure, but it also turns out Central Illinois and specifically Champaign County. Foreign-born people make up 1 in 5 residents in Urbana, 1 in 8 in Champaign, and 1 in 10 in total in the county. And that's not just students at the University of Illinois. We know this because of a new report about immigrants. It's part of a national study from the New America Economy, and it was created here locally by the New America Welcome Center at the University YMCA. Joining me to talk about this are Chris DeFranco from the New America Welcome Center at the University YMCA and Urbana Mayor Diane Marlin, both in studio with me here in Urbana. Thank you for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
As always, if you want to join the conversation, you're welcome to. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to us at 21STShow. Chris, when we look at these numbers, my first thought is, sure, Champaign County has a lot of international immigrants. It's because of the university and the student population. But your data shows that's not necessarily just the university that's contributing here.
That's right. There's a significant number of non-college student immigrants, so perhaps a population that we consider more permanent or more longer-term residents. And still, they're still considerable in number. They're more than half of the total immigrant population. And their characteristics are still very surprising. One of my favorite facts is that even outside, even not counting international students, international college students, you still have 76 countries represented in the more longer-term or permanent immigrant population here. That's almost a third of all the countries in the world.
And where are the majority of countries? There are a few countries where the majority of these immigrants are coming from, as well as the fastest growing regions also. Those are two different areas of the world.
Yeah, exactly. We're seeing a difference in those. So in our top regions, again, this is for non-college student immigrants, has been our East Asia, Europe and North and Central Asia, North America, so primarily Mexico, South and Southeast Asia. However, the fastest growing populations we're seeing are from Central Africa, East Africa, and Oceania.
And Mayor Marlin, what do we know from this report about the economic contributions of these immigrants? Because a lot of the report really captures a lot of this data as well.
It's huge. In 2016, the immigrant residents contributed almost $1.5 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars to the area's GDP. Immigrants, like everyone else, pay local sales taxes. They pay property taxes, any other taxes and fees. They contribute to the local economy. And the estimates are close to $450 million in spending power as well as generated by the immigrant population.
Chris, when we say spending power, what do we mean by that?
So it's everything, all the wealth left in immigrant households after taxes are paid. So this is likely wealth that is being reinvested into the local economy through through local purchases like groceries, but also purchases like accessories and cars.
Homes.
Because there's some data on home ownership as well, Chris, in terms of what Mayor Marlin, looks like you're looking that up right now in terms of what that looks like.
Yeah, it looks like almost $750 million in property value are held by immigrants in 2016 alone. So it's definitely a significant source of wealth.
Chris, where did the data in this report come from?
Sure. It comes from the a survey conducted by the U.S. Census Bureau every year. Because our population is so small, we had to put together 5 years' worth of survey to get reliable data. And that's why we have such confidence in these numbers.
And this is the Champaign County, and the University YMCA was actually selected by New America Economy to do this report. This was actually, other than the Chicago region, this is the only other place in Illinois where New America Economy is doing a report about the immigrant population. Am I correct about that?
This year, in this round, I believe that's correct, yes.
And why Champaign County?
I think we put forth I think Champaign is, and Champaign County is in such a perfect place right now to be a standard bearer for cities, for smaller cities having to, and smaller communities having to deal with their local immigrant population. So I think that the people at New American Economy saw that and saw the opportunity for us to be an example.
Mayor Marlin?
Well, Champaign County also was one of the few counties in Illinois that grew in population. Most other counties in the state are losing population, and I think our population growth was due to the foreign-born, the immigrant population.
Right. We've even seen numbers out today about how Chicago's population is on a decline.
Yeah. So the immigrant population is keeping our helping keep our economy healthy and growing and contributing richly to all aspects of our society, not just the economic aspects.
Well, and I think when we think about headlines and when we hear about immigrants in Urbana, I think we hear news headlines like the city, Mayor Marlin, and sanctuary status. Mm-hmm. What do you want people to take away from this report? This is a different kind of headline, I imagine.
This report really emphasizes the role that all people play in our society. And as you noted, you know, 1 in 5 residents in Urbana are born in a different country and 1 in 8 in Champaign. And the message here is that like every other period of our history, we are experiencing people coming to this country. I think of my my hometown of Streeter, Illinois, which was founded on really coal mining and manufacturing. That town was almost completely populated by waves of immigrants coming from mostly European countries and Eastern European countries to work in the coal mines, and they've now become part of that community for 150 years. So all our communities in this country are built from people coming from somewhere else, and we need to recognize that.
That's Urbana Mayor Diane Marlin. In studio with me here in Urbana is Chris DeFranco with the New America Welcome Center at the University YMCA. And Minister Cesar Impara is also with us from Champaign's First Presbyterian Church. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Cesar, I wonder if you can share, you were a mining industry lawyer in the Congo, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Correct.
When did you come to the U.S.?
6 years ago, we came in on November 17.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And why did you come here?
That's a long story.
And there's a lot of reasons.
But let me correct my name. My name is Mnyampara, mm-hmm. Cesar. And we have many reasons to come here, United States. First of all, we have a poor country. Even if it's a rich country, but we are poor. That's the first reason. Secondly, my dad was a politician, and he was killed by our government. Mm. And they decided also to disappear my family. Fortunately for us, my wife got a lottery visa, and the U.S. Embassy helped everyone to come here in the United States.
And you settled here in Champaign.
Exactly.
You and your wife.
And my 5 kids.
What you were sharing with me before we went on air about the church and the church here in Champaign, how did they help you get settled in the U.S.?
It's again a long story. Because of a old lady, I love this lady, Mrs. Ha Ho is from Vietnam. She tried to make a connection with my friend, brother, Robert Kirby. For me, it's an angel, this man. And because of Ha Ho, I met Robert Kirby. And together we try to work and build a strong relationship. And right now we have a big ministry, French ministry, together with Brother Bob Kirby.
And the people at the church, were there specific things they did to help you feel welcomed or getting accustomed to life here in the U.S.?
If I receive a call from God, I think the most of part is from this church. Because when I came... Remember, we came here, you don't speak English. English was the first challenge for you, so you have to learn English, and because of this church. To be honest with you guys, I did not go to the Parkland College or adult education to learn my English. But this church, member of the church, came to my house every day, anytime, to help me to perform my English. That was a big point for me. And when we came for the first time also, can you imagine to see old people welcome to you as a son for them? And my wife and me said, we are here in your family in the United States. And God's brought us here in our new family. And it's unbelievable to see this kind of people in my church.
And Cesar, now you were helping other, it's been 7 years.
Exactly. That's why I decided to help also people, because my fear is I don't want to see people suffer as I suffer in this country. You know, learn English, new people, new challenge in a new country is very hard. That's why I decide, my wife and me, to be close of people, to understand their needs and to help. What I do right now, I try to help them to find a job, house, to get a better life.
And to learn what it's like to live in the United States.
Exactly, especially rural constitution of this country. That's what the church teach me. And still teaching me again.
We're talking with Cesar Muyampara.
Muyampara, exactly. Perfect.
And Chris DeFranco with the New American Welcome Center of the University, YMCA. Chris, as you're listening to Cesar's story, you all also help. There's sort of two parts of this report, right? Because we've heard the data, but then there's also the work that you all do with the university, YMCA. As you're listening to Cesar's story, I wonder what kind of work you all do to also integrate and welcome new immigrants into Champaign County.
Absolutely. The University YMCA has this fantastic program that they've been running for several years now, and they've been building up so much called La Línea, which is a multilingual call-in helpline that helps immigrants, local immigrants, with their needs, basically around the board. And we are able to benefit from the knowledge and experience of members of the New American Welcome Center, partners of the New American Welcome Center, like Cesar, who have enormous, so many resources and knowledge on how to help immigrants integrate into various aspects of our community. And so I think that La Línea, the University Y, has to be lauded for their work in creating and maintaining La Línea.
Mayor Marlin, what would you like? What do you think the role we're seeing social service agencies and churches, which traditionally have played a long-standing role in this country in helping integrate and welcome immigrants? What role would you like to see cities and other? If we're thinking about this throughout Central Illinois and not just Champaign County, what would you like to see happen?
Well, first of all, is the public stance or the public affirmation and support for our immigrant community. And I think the Sanctuary City Resolution that we passed about a year and a half ago really affirms basic human rights for all of our residents, no matter where they're born, and that was an important step. We also, the city, through its, we have a social service funding program through the city and the township. We directly provide financial support, for example, to the New American Welcome Center and other agencies that in turn support our immigrant population. And I think we can. I would love to see more the population more better represented on our numerous boards and commissions, for example, so that it better reflects our community. And we're working on that as well. But I think cities have to make sure the doors are open, and reports like this really give us the data and information that we can share that shows people what contribution that people from all over the world make to this community. One of the statistics that leaps out here is that in Urbana, almost 3/4 of the immigrant population is employed in the education sector. And a lot of that, of course, has to do with the University of Illinois, but we also see that in Parkland and our school system as well. So the contributions made to our workforce, to our technology industry, to our education sector, to our healthcare. I know the hospitals are recruiting people outside the United States to work in the hospitals for the especially like nursing staff. So any employment sector you go to, you'll find contributions from people born elsewhere.
There's lots in this report. We will have this up at our website and tweet it out as well. But I want to thank Krista Franco with the New American Welcome Center at the University YMCA. Urbana Mayor Diane Marlin, you were just hearing about Pastor Cesar Mayampara from First Presbyterian Church of Champaign. Thank you all for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you'll stay with us here on the 21st. Coming up, we're going to be talking about violence against nurses in Illinois. Stay tuned. We'll get that conversation started just after the break. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Nurses are the people who care for us, but what about how we care for them? A new report from the University of Illinois finds that 90% of nurses it surveyed in Illinois experienced some form of violence at least once over the past year. And what's more, 50% of those nurses said they experienced violence 6 or more times in the same time period on the job. The survey highlights the harsh reality that nurses around the state have been dealing with. Just last year, there were 2 separate hostage situations that happened involving nurses, one in Geneva and one in Joliet. The situation in Geneva led to the sexual assault of one nurse when a prisoner was left unshackled, and the deputy that was supposed to be taking care of that prisoner was found sleeping. House Bill 4100 is an effort to remedy some of this. It passed the House yesterday. It would require violence prevention training as well as whistleblower protections for workers who report assaults. State Representative Stephanie Kiefewit is on the line with us now from Springfield. She represents Illinois' 84th district, which includes the Chicago suburbs of Aurora, Naperville, and Oswego, and she was co-sponsor of the Healthcare Worker Violence Prevention Act. Representative Kiefewit, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with me.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
What would this bill do? What protections would it put in place?
Well, generally speaking, what this bill does is raises the discussion of workplace violence and workplace violence prevention methods, such as working with hospitals with a violence prevention committee, putting into law OSHA violence prevention guidelines. In addition to that, having, as you said, whistleblower protection so that somebody is being subject to violence or violent conditions, that they have the freedom to report that person. And we also want individuals that are aggressive and that assault nurses and healthcare workers to be charged and held accountable for their actions.
Representative, is this something that surprised you, these numbers? I find it a little alarming how high the incidences were reported in the survey. I imagine this is what led you to want to have this act passed?
Oh, absolutely. I, like many other, are unaware of the situations that nurses find themselves in. I do have an ER nurse in my district, and she told me about some of the things she has to deal with in the emergency room. We did pass legislation a couple of years ago to increase the penalty if you do assault a nurse or an emergency room nurse, but we didn't have a comprehensive plan. And what this law does is give a comprehensive violent prevention workplace plan. In addition to that, it has parameters with regards to individuals that are under the custody of a law enforcement or a jail. And at the bottom line is we were able to expand it from just nurses to actually acknowledge that front care healthcare workers, nurses assistants, and other individuals could be subject to violence as well.
Mm. Alice Johnson is also with us. She's executive director of the Illinois Nurses Association. She's on the line from Chicago. Hi, Alice. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Alice, when we look at this survey data from the University of Illinois, that 90% of nurses that were surveyed experienced some form of violence at least once over the past year on the job. Was that number surprising to you?
From my work at the Illinois Nurses Association, as a nurses union, it wasn't. It's shocking to see it in black and white. But I can tell you from our work here over the years, just what we had heard anecdotally, we knew there was a lot of workplace violence going on. What we didn't have was, black and white data from, specifics on what is happening in Illinois. So for us to get this information, it was really important to us to be able to say, this is how often this is happening, and not just what we knew anecdotally. I mean, we would hear stories of workplace violence, happening to our members, and it was really disturbing. But, now we have some data that we can rely on. Also, the responses to the workplace violence by management, we knew that the responses weren't really adequate. But also, to have data that says when nurses are reporting workplace violence, they're not being supported, they're not given the tools that they need to really recover from that and to do the best work possible. That was important for us to have that data as well.
I want to just start with the incidences in particular first, Alice. Can you give us a sense, when we say workplace violence against nurses, what kind of things are we talking about? And is this patients who are committing this in general?
It's a variety of workplace violence. A lot of the workplace violence is is committed by patients. At times it could be a patient's family member. It could be, a guest in the hospital. It could be somebody that, isn't even supposed to be in the hospital. From what we see, a lot of violence takes place in emergency rooms where, people are stressed out. They've been waiting a long time. Mental health settings as well can be very dangerous. And, there's a variety of violence that takes place, kicking, physical slapping, there's verbal threats, all types of, an array of violence that happens.
That's Alice Johnson. She's executive director of the Illinois Nurses Association. State Representative Stephanie Kiefewit is also on the line with us. Representative Kiefewit, I wonder, I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation the two separate hostage situations that happened last year. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about that and how much of that was also a catalyst for you to have this legislation.
Well, I think it absolutely was a catalyst. But what was more of a catalyst was the nurses coming together and having a rally and really starting to let their voices be heard, because they were just fed up with the way they've been treating, which is completely understandable. So while I learned of the situation and was appalled of the situation at Delnor, I was more appalled when I attended the rally and heard firsthand accounts from nurses of everyday occurrences that were brushed off as part of the job. Just 2 weeks ago, a friend of mine sent me a picture of her sister, who's a nurse, that got punched in the face, broken teeth, split lip, her jaw's out of line from a patient. So when you start really realizing that our healthcare workers are being abused on a daily basis and then realize that it's becoming normal, we have to act and say it's not normal and it's not right. And that was the justification for this law.
And Alice, when we hear Representative Kivowitz say that it's quote unquote normal, what I want to get to, when something like this would happen, I would think, when you just think about a workplace, any workplace, if someone was punched in the face, I think there would be an HR conversation. There's like OSHA regulations. There's sort of all of these things that kind of kick in. Why is that not happening in a hospital setting?
When the nurses are reporting it, there's kind of a couple things that happened. They're given the response that this is part of the job. It isn't treated as, you know, this is something that's a priority. We need to deal with it. We need to, address the nurses' needs. We need to do an analysis to make sure that, this doesn't happen again. That's not what's going on when these incidents take place. Even worse than that, a lot of times the nurse is made to feel like it's her fault. They're asked to fill out an incident report, saying, what could you have done differently? I'm aware of one incident where a nurse had to restrain a patient. Actually, it wasn't a patient. It was a friend of somebody in the ER, and he had to restrain that patient because the patient was actually becoming physically aggressive. And that nurse was disciplined. So they're not only are their needs not addressed of, there might be, physical injury that's happened. There's also psychological and emotional injury. And then in addition to that, they have to worry about getting written up or getting in trouble for how they address the situation.
And Alice, does this extend to other forms of harassment as well, as opposed to, we're talking about violence, does this also happen? Are there sexual harassment? Is that also a problem?
Yes, there is sexual harassment that is, a problem that takes place in a number of settings that can happen in a hospital from, other healthcare workers. Sometimes the response to a nurse reporting sexual harassment is, it's not a very aggressive response. It's sometimes the response to that is inadequate. And I know of one instance where we've had a nurse who reported sexual harassment, and it was kind of treated as a he said she said type of thing. I'm aware of another case where a nurse was actually sexually assaulted, and as the union, we really had to push to get that situation addressed. It was a situation where a patient, we thought there was the nurses believed there was a likelihood that the patient would, could sexually assault somebody and act out, and did not feel that the patient was on the appropriate unit. And that is exactly what happened. That patient sexually assaulted a nurse. So there's sexual harassment, sexual assault takes place, and currently the response to, those concerns being brought up and the response when incidents do happen is not adequate.
Alice, or actually Representative Kivowitz, as I'm listening to all of this, I can't help but think of the majority of nurses tend to be female. And I wonder, Representative Kivowitz, if you think that's part of the issue here? Is it just a cultural problem of women and having these instances not taken seriously?
Well, I think it's twofold. I think it's a little bit of that, but I just think that it's the normalization of assault and that people tend to justify things, as Alice said, as oh, it's a mishap with the patient, the patient's not on the right medications, or the nurse did something wrong, or they didn't. And so there's these excuses to cover it up or to just justify it. And one of the programs that were put into the bill is to give the nurses access to mental health care. And if they are a victim of assault, that they should be afforded to be able to utilize mental health services, because it's very traumatic to be assaulted in the place that you work and then to have to come back 2 or 3 days later into the same work environment. It's very stressful, and we want our healthcare workers to be focused on providing healthcare. So I think we're starting to break out of this stereotype that assault is okay and all that is okay, and start really demanding that our nurses be treated properly. And it could be a gender bias. It could just be a workplace violence, because they're supposed to be giving help. And so they can be taken advantage of in that role, too. And we are working very hard to stop that.
Alice, to Representative Kiefowitz's point, in the survey, it found that almost every nurse that was surveyed continued to work immediately after these incidents of violence. Is that because you think there is this culture of normalization around it?
I think there's a couple of things. One is the culture of normalization, that it's somehow okay for nurses to be assaulted, which it absolutely is not. I think the second piece to that is that there's not enough staff. Sometimes there just isn't enough staff in the hospital to relieve somebody so that they can go home. I think that's another important piece of solving the issue of workplace violence, is that there has to be enough staff. And, number one, to address, to address the issue if somebody is assaulted. Also, if there's more staff, if there's enough staff there to do the job, it's less likely that, patients are going to be waiting for longer periods of time. It raises the stress level for everybody, healthcare workers and patients, if there's not enough staff there. And finally, we have settings where nurses are working alone. So if there's not another staff person there, one, there's nobody to cover for them if something does happen, but also you're just less safe when you're working by yourself.
Representative Kiefowitz, I mentioned at the beginning that this Healthcare Worker Violence Prevention Act passed the House yesterday. What's next for the bill?
It passed unanimously in the House, and we expect it to pass close to unanimously, if not unanimously, in the Senate, and we will put it on the governor's desk.
And have you had any conversations with Governor Rauner's staff or his office about signing this?
They have not reached out to me. Of course, it just passed yesterday, so I'm expecting them to reach out. And I'm expecting the governor to sign it, because we cannot be a state that allows our nurses to work in environments of violence. It's just not right.
Alice, apart from this, what else needs to be done to help cut down on these incidents of violences against nurses?
I think we touched on it earlier with having enough staff, having safe staffing minimums for nurses, it not overloading nurses with too many patients. If a nurse has too many patients, it increases the likelihood of death and failure to rescue for patients. So it's kind of a basic for patient safety, and also it makes the nurses safer if and all the healthcare workers safer if there's enough staff. And I think they're also just Representative Kiefowitz was saying, we need a cultural change where we say that, violence against healthcare workers, violence against nurses is not acceptable, and we are going to treat nurses' safety as a priority so that they are able to work in an environment where they can provide the best patient care possible.
I want to thank Alice Johnson for being with us. She's executive director of the Illinois Nurses Association, also State Representative Stephanie Kiefowitz. Thank you both for being with me to talk about this. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for bringing up the subject.
We will tweet out more information about the Healthcare Worker Violence Prevention Act. If you want to leave us a voicemail comment, you always can. That number is 217-300-2121. Coming up, we're going to hear about how Chicago Bears players are reacting to the NFL's announcement yesterday that players will be fined for taking a knee during the national anthem. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last year, the NFL had plenty of people tuning in to the beginning of their games to see the widespread player protests about police brutality that took place during the national anthem. Many of them knelt. The hashtag was Take a Knee. Yesterday, the NFL came down with a verdict about how players are protesting, saying that if they take a knee, they will be fined. How did Chicago Bears players react?
From the beginning, no one's intent and I think no one's purpose was to disrespect the flag. Everyone's purpose, starting with Colin Kaepernick, Michael Thomas, Eric Reed, who still doesn't have a job, was to protest police brutality against people of color. And so I think that still stands, right?
Bears linebacker and union representative Sam Acho, WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Ray Stout was with Sam yesterday. She joins us now. Hi, Cheryl. Welcome back to The 21st.
Hello. How are you?
Thank you. I'm good. Thanks, Cheryl. Yesterday, so the NFL had this ruling yesterday saying that they're going to, I think the exact language, Cheryl, is it that NFL players that are on the field during the anthem will have to, quote, stand and respect the flag. Cheryl, did we expect an official ruling to come down on this?
We weren't sure. The other part of that is also if they decide to stay, if they don't want to stand for the flag, they can stay in the locker room. And so they're making the players make a choice. We had heard the night before that they were talking about if a player kneels that they were going to do a 15-yard penalty. This kind of was a shockwave throughout the NFL. And the other factor is they didn't include the union. They never talked to the union about this.
The players'
so
union.
This could be the players' union. Players' union was never talked to about this. So this could have ramifications down the line that we don't even know yet.
And so we just heard a little bit of the Bears players union representative, Sam Acho, right? Let's hear a little bit more of him yesterday from this news conference.
You know, we some guys on the team, we do a Bible study in the morning, and we were reading James 2. It talks about faith without works is dead. It's one thing to have faith and say you believe in something. It's a total different thing to actually do something about it. That's why I salute Cap. I salute Eric Reed, Michael Thomas, all these guys who have, from the beginning, stood up for injustice. And some of them don't have jobs right now. Colin Kaepernick is not in the NFL. Eric Reed is not in the NFL. They're paying the price.
Cheryl, it sounds like from what you hear of Sam there, this is a movement that started. And as he's talking about Colin Kaepernick and all of these other folks, this doesn't sound like something that's going to go away.
Not at all, because the owners decided to do something that the players don't agree with. And so we'll see what happens. I just get a feeling we don't know yet. Because I think the players, you know, they're just having their OTAs right now. They're not really, a lot of teams aren't even together yet at this point. So once they get together, they're going to have to make a decision what they want to do. Now Sam also talked about that they, whatever they would do in unison. And last year, of course, they were a team that did not kneel, but they did lock arms, you know, so they have done that. But we don't know if there's going to be a change. And also with the Bears, they've got some new players. They may have some different ideas. And this was also on the background what happened just hours later when the Milwaukee police released a video of Sterling Brown, who was tased by police for a parking violation. And that kind of validates why the players kneeled and did what they did.
And now Sterling Brown is a basketball player for the Bucks. And can you tell us a little bit about that? Because as you mentioned, that arrest video was released. What's been, how has the NBA responded to this?
Well, the Milwaukee Bucks had a very stern and they really eviscerated the Milwaukee Police Department. They did say, you know, we appreciate them, you know, we believe in the police, but in this instance, they are standing by Sterling Brown, and also Sterling Brown is going to be suing the police.
And so the statement, right, I've got the statement here, and it is, as you said, Cheryl, this is what the abuse and intimidation that Sterling experienced at the hands of Milwaukee police was shameful and inexcusable. Sterling has our full support as he shares his story and takes action to provide accountability. Unfortunately, this isn't an isolated case. It shouldn't require an incident involving a professional athlete to draw attention to the fact that vulnerable people in our communities have experienced similar and even worse treatment.
Yeah, and to bring up the other factors, now the NBA Players Union with the league, they made the decision not to do any kneeling, that they will stand for the national anthem. But the league does support them in any cause that they have in concerning something like this. And so there will be a full support by the NBA and the Milwaukee Bucks for this player, which is different than what the NFL has done.
Right. So it seems like there's really two very different ways in how these two different sport leagues have responded to this issue of police brutality, and particularly when it comes to how professional athletes are taking a stand on this.
Absolutely. And it probably be widened even more as time goes on. You know, social media has made it a platform where the NBA players use that to get their points across, and that's why they seem to have more strength in there. And in the NFL, here's the difference. In the NFL, a lot of players do not have guaranteed contracts. So they are afraid to say or do anything because they could get cut and never work again.
Well, which has happened with Colin Kaepernick, not that he's never going to work again, but he's not working right now.
Absolutely. So there is a big divide as far as that goes, you know, as far as having the comfort of being able to speak out without having financial ramifications. That's the big difference. However, you know, the NBA is always, but the league and the players have always worked together. They've actually, you know, they've had some contract disputes, but in most cases they've worked together where the players union in the NFL And the owners, you know, they're making a lot of money. They're making billions of dollars. And the CEOs of those companies feel the pressure of the president. They feel the pressure of their fans. And so this is a financial thing as far as they're concerned. And they don't want to lose money that they think that they're losing because of this.
But speaking of money, Cheryl, we also saw some team owners saying yesterday they will pay the fines for players if players want to take a knee.
Yes, the New York Jets, one of their owners, said that they would, which, again, that opens up the can of worms. That means that not all the owners are, and so you're opening it up. And so it's going to be interesting to see what Jets players do. I have a feeling, I don't know this for a fact, that they may make a stand on this because they have the support of their owner.
Right. Very different differences between, obviously, the NFL and the NBA. I wonder if we can switch to talking about baseball for a moment and to not necessarily sports protests, but just sports, and ask you about the Cubs. They're 25-21. And how are they doing this year? How did last night's Cleveland Indians last night, right?
Yeah, they lost again to the Indians 1-0. In fact, the Indians rookie pitcher had a no-hitter going into, you know, through the sixth inning. John Lester pitched. Here's the problem with the Cubs this year. They are inconsistent. They could look brilliant sometimes with the starting pitching and sometimes with the hitting and sometimes both, but not always. And, in fact, you know, the best person to say to us was Chris Bryant says, we are just average right now. And that's not what people want to hear. And he's a consistent. He's one of the
say, no one wants to hear the Cubs say after they've 2 years after they've won the World Series that they're just average. Darvish? That was supposed to be the big free agent signing. That pitcher, right? He used to play for the Dodgers and the Rangers.
Right. He was traded to the Dodgers midseason last year. Previously with the Rangers, he got a $126 million contract. So the expectations are going to be big. He didn't get his first win until May 20th. Think about that. You're getting all that money. He got his first win. He's only got one win. But they think that was an important win because they think there's mental issues with him or, you know, something about that he doesn't get over the hump and maybe he'll be able to pitch better. If he doesn't, it would be a big loss for them as far as making that signing because their two top starters in John Lester and Kyle Hendricks have pitched well. But their other three, including Yu Darvish, and the other player that they signed, the free agent pitcher they signed, was Tyler Chatwood. He's been very bad. So if they don't get that on track, this is going to be a long season.
Let's switch to the Sox. Big news with catcher Wellington Castillo. There is an official word now that he's been suspended. Yes. Is it 80 games, Cheryl?
80 games, yes. He tested, it's not a steroid. It's a drug that is on the you're not supposed to use list, and he did take it. He did take ownership of that. He cannot be with the team. In fact, he's gone for the team right now for 80 games. He was their starting catcher. He was somebody.
Isn't that like half
really
the season? 80 games?
Yeah. Half the season. I mean, it's good. He'd probably be back at the end, maybe, if they have him back. The sad part about it is that this particular catcher that they signed up for this year was really somebody that was helping some of these pitchers. You know, he's a veteran. He also can hit. He had an interesting thing that happened the other day where he didn't run on a pop-out. And so Ricky Renteria benched him. So we had that earlier in the week, and then, of course, today he gets suspended. So it's going to be a tough blow for this team that's young and trying to, you know, improve, and you lose a veteran in your lineup. And, you know, it's a price you pay when you do something that you're not supposed to do.
All right, so we've talked Cubs, Sox. Let's talk about the Cardinals for a minute. They're actually just ahead of the Cubs, the St. Louis Cardinals, 26-21. Do you think the Cardinals are playing as well as their fans have hoped? Is that a better story here?
It is an interesting story because they have three starting pitchers that have been out: Adam Wainwright, Carlos Martinez, who is the ERA leader, and Alex Reyes, who is supposed to be back in a few days. You think about that. You're losing three starters and you're still in the mix. Also, when they lost all-star catcher Yadier Molina, you know, he's recovering from groin surgery, you would think this team would be at a dead stop. But they have a spotlight that should be shining on Milos Mikolas. He's 6-0. He's got ERA at 2.24. He's really pitched well. They have a big series this weekend against the Pirates, who they got swept by a few weeks ago. They're in the mix. And if they could get healthy and get some offensive production, they could be in the mix all the way through the season. That's a surprise.
So do we see now that the Cubs and the Cards are pretty close in the standings, do we see a rekindling of that Cubs-Cards rivalry?
Well, the whole division's like that. You know, if you look at anybody right now, you know, Milwaukee, you know, you've got Pittsburgh, who wasn't expected to do anything. It always can be a great rivalry no matter what. And if they stay in the race together, it would be very interesting because at the end of the season, they wind up the regular season at Wrigley Field. And if the Cubs can swing the deal for Manny Machado, could be very interesting.
We're talking sports with WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Ray-Stout. I wanted to end, Cheryl, by just asking about something completely different, which is the possible legalization of sports betting. And that's because earlier this month, the Supreme Court struck down a federal law that had banned sports betting in most states, which means states can now decide if they want to legalize sports gambling if they choose to. That hasn't happened yet in Illinois, but it is a possibility. I wonder, Cheryl, as someone, you're there with the teams, you're talking to athletes and coaches, the people who are in these sports that people could be betting on. What are people saying about this?
Well, the pro teams, they're embracing it because they think they get more revenue out of it. There's a belief that with new stadiums that they could incorporate betting casinos or maybe a parlor at least. And then when you look at fantasy sports, how that has grown, gambling now will broaden that, which will have the casual fan tune into games, maybe go see a game that they normally wouldn't because they have money on it. Now, that's the upside as far as that is concerned. There is concern about the downside, which means that a player, if he's injured, you know, there'd be, you know, pressure to get information about him. You got some players that will maybe be broached to try to throw games, which did happen with college basketball. We do know that it's happened in the past. So there's got to be concerns about that. And that's where, you know, the big question mark is, how do you regulate this? How do you do this without having the integrity of the game suffer? And that's going to be a concern going forward.
Lots going on in the world of sports. Thanks to Cheryl Ray-Stout, WBEZ sports contributor in Chicago, for getting us up to date on all of these stories. Cheryl, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Nyla.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow we'll be having an early Memorial Day celebration by bringing you the story of a Peoria woman who never knew her father had received a Purple Heart for his service in World War II until recently. Tune in tomorrow for that. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa and NPR One, you can also have play us there. You do have to have NPR One enabled, but all you have to do is say, Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. You can also search for us on Facebook. Look for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Morg. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a good day.